This episode is sponsored in part by Viral Sweep. When was the last time you ran a sweepstakes or giveaway? If you're worried about staying legally compliant or figuring out fair winner selection, meet Viral Sweep, the best viral marketing app for Shopify stores. With Viral Sweep, you could build, run, and manage all kinds of campaigns that drive traffic and boost your brand's visibility. Want to engage your customers? Use Viral Sweep's Instagram giveaway picker, or save yourself time with automated winner selection and prize distribution. Viral Sweep also ensures your promotions stay legally compliant so you can run campaigns without a hitch. Plus, you'll get impactful analytics and seamless integrations to keep everything smooth. Need help? Viral Sweep's support team has you covered with options for managed services too. Supercharge your customer engagement today. Download Viral Sweep on the Shopify App Store and start creating contests that grow your brand. New customers can get 50% off of Viral Sweep's annual plan. Just tell them in the live chat that the unofficial Shopify podcast sent you. That's Viral Sweep. Today on the unofficial Shopify podcast, how a simple Twitter account became a thriving Shopify brand. Yes, a mountain, an idea, and a Twitter account now is a line of products you could purchase in REI. How did that happen? Well, we're going to find out when we hear from David Lindahl of Rain Your Watch. David, how you doing? Welcome to the show.
Good. Stoked to officially be here, but I'm a little ill, but I'm doing great.
You know, it's that time of year. It's Q1. It's cold out. We're all a little sick. But okay, tell me what Rain Your Watch is, because I know it started as a Twitter account over 10 years ago.
Not a watch company. Let me get that out there right away. Although I may have plans for April Fools. We'll see. I don't know.
So not a watch company yet.
Yet. I get that all the time, which makes sense.
A Twitter account called Rain Your Watch that doesn't sell watches, but is instead about a mountain.
Yeah, it's basically how I describe it as kind of a fan club, fan fest, sort of community driven love affair for the mountain. It's this landmark that you can see on the horizon when it's sunny out and clear, which being the Pacific Northwest, the rumors are true. It rains quite a bit. So that's only 50 to 75 days a year, roughly, that the mountain is out, quote unquote. So it's a local phrase. It's a local sort of awesome thing that people love and they look forward to. And so years and years and years ago, I was commuting into downtown Seattle on a bus and wanted to know, like, is there some sort of way for people to know if the mountain's out? Back then there wasn't. So I started tweeting and then it kind of just snowballed from there, kind of went up and down different peaks and valleys. But now we're here today and I'm designing and selling merchandise that's all inspired by the mountain. I give back a portion to the national parks because that is kind of core to the mission of the brand. But it's been quite the journey learning pretty much everything myself as I go.
And was I correct? Do you have products in REI?
Yeah, I think it's 11 stores in Washington at last count, which there's a lot of REI stores in Washington. So it's a good state to be in.
So really this, it starts as a hobby on Twitter where you're posting photographs. How does that become a brand? Like, that's a hobby. It sounds fun, but why build a whole store about it?
It wasn't right away. It definitely took many years. And there's a couple of years where I didn't tweet a whole lot if you were to look at like a Twitter timeline. And then I don't know what kind of sparked the idea, but I'm sure some people asked about stickers. How can we, you know, let's get some mountain stickers and that sort of thing. So I built first couple of versions of the store were terrible. First couple of versions of all the products were pretty bad. And it just kind of grew from there, but it's been really, really fun to be able to design and make physical products. Like, I come from a background in web development and before that financial services. And so like, it's all kind of like computer things. And so it's really cool to be able to go, hey, look, I'm going to design this and then make it and touch it and hold it and wear it. And one of the coolest things ever, I know a lot of brand owners will say this, but like one of the coolest things ever, and it still blows my mind to this day to see other people that have spent their hard-earned cash, like, purchasing my products and wearing them out in the wild. I usually just go, like, white. And I'm like, what? That's a real human over there wearing my shirt.
Do you ever approach them, or is it too weird?
I haven't yet. I've been... one of my favorite stories was, like, early, a couple of years ago, when the brand wasn't as big as it is now. I was walking down the aisle on an airplane flight with my wife, and I was holding like the hat in my hand, one of the original hats. And someone said, as I was walking down the aisle, "Hey, is that a Rewatch hat?" And I didn't know what to say. I was just like shocked that someone else in the world knew about this little tiny thing that felt like I was shouting into the void all the time. I was like, "Yeah, it is." And I kept going. And I regret not saying, "Oh yeah, that's my company." I do it a little bit more. I've sort of broken through that wall a little bit, but it feels, I don't know, very uncomfortable and very awkward for the introvert in me.
I've learned to keep my mouth shut. I've been doing this over 10 years, and we've managed some pretty big Shopify brands. And so it's not uncommon for me to encounter them in the wild. And I used to just blurt out. I'd be like, "Oh my gosh, you know, Hoonigan, Harney, whatever. I managed that website." And every time they would stare at me like I was the biggest liar in the universe. And so I just was like, "Oh, hey, you know, you're a fan of that. Cool." Then I move on with my life.
No one cares, yeah. Kurt. No one cares.
Yeah, nobody cares. So I learned the hard way. But yeah, it is weird. You know, obviously this would have started as a side hustle. I saw on Twitter, have you moved this into a warehouse?
Yeah, started in my spare bedroom a couple of years ago, the shop, when I launched it. I think I officially launched it in 2018. And then it outgrew the spare bedroom, and my wife was like, "We need to be able to walk down our hall. Like, what are you doing here?" Like, okay. So I built a spare...
It's starting to look like a hoarder situation. It's turning into a fire hazard.
Yep, exactly. This is not fire department approved. So I built this backyard office shed that I'm in now, which was probably 2-3 years ago. And it's 200 square feet, so it's a good size. But within a year or two, boxes were spilling out onto the lawn. Like, it was overfilled with product. And product, like t-shirts and sweatshirts and that sort of thing, they take up a good amount of space, hats and beanies. And so now I'm in a local warehouse that I have, that I found. And I have someone helping ship my orders. Like, I'm being pretty lean as I go, but slowly kind of diversifying the tasks a little bit. So it's not just me doing everything, which is how it started.
What's the turning point where you start to feel like Rainier Watch could become a sustainable business as opposed to hobby or passion project?
That sort of thought realization hit me in the last year or two. And for the longest time, it was more of just like, this is a fun little passion project. It's something I do on the weekends or whatever. It's like what I do. I remember spending my lunch breaks on Instagram and that sort of thing, like super getting up at 5 a.m. and working on it before the day job, like all sorts of the typical side hustle kind of activities. But it's really felt like over the last 2 years, it's got a lot of momentum. Getting into REI was one of the biggest tipping points. I think there was just like a multiplier effect from that, where there's a legitimacy of being in there. There's obviously the wholesale revenue that's coming in from that. But I think there's been huge steps. So if you look at the growth charts from Rainier Watch, from going from like a little side hustle revenue to like, okay, this could be a real thing. Obviously the TAM isn't very big. It's a very niche kind of geo-specific brand, but I've got thoughts and ideas about that as I look forward, look at the future and think about the 1 to 5 year plan for the brand. So that's been something that has really hit me with the last 2 years. Well, it's like, hey, this could be a job, which is fun because I love it. And like, I'm sitting here all day doing things that I would rather be designing new jackets, for example, like working on new products and designing out new stuff. And that's just, that keeps me going.
So getting into REI is a big moment. That's a big deal. How did that partnership come about?
With the coolest email I've ever gotten.
They reached out to you?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It was unreal. It was unreal. So I was sitting there and this email came through that was like, "Hey, I'm a store manager at a local REI. I saw your brand. I'd love to carry it in my store. Can we chat?" And I was like, "Is this phishing? Is this real?" I showed my wife, ran inside like, it's REI. It's a brand. It's a company I've looked up to for many, many years. My dad would drag us hours away to the closest REI growing up. And so it's been just unreal to think of them as a partner. And it's a little bit different than their typical wholesale process. Like, I'm not in their national chains. I'm just in the local stores here in Washington, but it started with one shop. And I know the store owner, she's awesome. And it grew from there. Basically, it kind of just snowballed and other stores were like, "Oh, that's cool. That's selling well. Like, let's carry it." And then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, I think it's 11, like I was saying earlier now.
And you, even with that local presence, that's still significant. Being in one REI store would be nice. Being in 11 is great. So I wouldn't undersell the impact of that. Because you mentioned the REI ripple effect, right? Where people are discovering it in store and then they're buying online. You know, what's your perception of the impact of having that retail partnership?
Huge. Yeah. I mean, I don't have exact numbers, but I do have a a post-purchase survey set up, shout out Kano. And so there's people that will respond in those surveys like, hey, I saw an REI, and I get people all the time that will mention that. And I feel like it's a huge, it builds so much brand equity. It's like a cornerstone of the brand, be like, hey, we're an REI. And it also helps being a foundation for other wholesale accounts too. Hey, we've got products in this store. This is like the biggest name for outdoor retailing in our region, if not like top five in the country kind of thing. Like it's a huge name. And so people seeing it there, people love to be able to touch apparel products and see them in person. I've done many pop-ups over the years, and that's like a huge takeaway from that experience is people want to touch the things. And also my shirts are like the softest t-shirts that you'll find according to my customers. And so them being able to touch and hold those.
The store's on Shopify now, and that's part of why we're here. Prior to Shopify, you know, when you were just doing stickers, it wasn't on Shopify, was it?
Oh man. V1 was on Card, like CARRD, the single page web builder. Ew. Horrific website. Yeah, that's my reaction. This was before I was in web development. So this was like many, many years ago. And like, I didn't know what I was doing. And it was so ugly and terrible. And it was linked to, I don't even remember how the payments were processed. Gumroad, maybe?
Okay.
Couple stickers. That was it. After that, I moved it to Big Cartel when I got a couple t-shirts in. And then after that, I moved it to WooCom. It was on WooCom for a couple of years because I was like...
So you tried them all.
Oh, yeah. I was a web developer at that point. I was like, I can manage a server. That sounds fun. Who loves DevOps?
No one loves DevOps.
Yeah. Don't do it. That's one of my biggest regrets, actually, for running my store is not being on Shopify from day one. After WooCom, I went to a headless Shopify build that I built. Also a big mistake.
You're like, all right, no matter what, let's just pick the harder tools. So once you finally get around to adopting Shopify... truthfully, I'm in the same boat. Our agency site, we've been managing our own LAMP stack for over a decade, and I'm finally moving it to Shopify. And so I'm looking forward to that.
Nice.
But once you saw the light, you moved it to Shopify. How did that what was that experience? How did that fix some of your challenges?
Amazing. It was amazing. So before that, I was using Square as a POS for a lot of the pop-ups. I was having to sync orders between WooCom and Square and having to either pay for an app to do that, or it was just a giant headache and it didn't work. And there's inventory issues all over the place. And it was also just hard to use. You know, you spend half your time in WooCom updating all the plugins to make sure there's not some sort of security vulnerability. The
other half anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
I used to be a WordPress developer, and man, it was just like, you'd get those emails weekly. They're like, hey, I got hacked again. You're like, okay, let's figure this out.
Yeah. And being a UI UX guy, like the Shopify UI UX just blows away WooCom. Like it's 1,000 years in the future, better, way more features. The environment and the feature set, everything's more robust. I remember being off put by the price, like the monthly fixed cost. But you know, at that point, when you're managing your own server and then adding then things, it is cheaper actually to use Shopify. There's more things out of the box that you can do. The app ecosystem is like insanely powerful.
And that documentation, oh my gosh, consistent, coherent, generally up-to-date documentation.
Yeah.
You mentioned you, when you went to Shopify, you're like, hey, I'm a nut, developer. And so you did a headless solution. Tell me about, it for someone who's not experienced with this, you know, what advice you would give someone considering a headless solution on Shopify?
Don't do it. Don't do it.
But why?
Being a developer... Oftentimes you fall into the trap of like, I'll build it myself and it'll be better and I'll have more control that way. And so the headless, that was one of the allure of the headless. I was also like, oh, I'll experiment and try this out and see what happens. It wasn't from scratch. I was using like a package basically on my favorite CMS platform. And so the CMS itself was like really powerful and it was really good for content, but it was definitely lacking when it came to e-com. And it got to the point where it was just maintenance was too much. And I would recommend like headless is great if you have enough budget to pay for at least one or two full-time developers, which is not cheap. And like, there's other advantages maybe there, but like overall there's, I feel like very small situations where headless would make sense, especially in today's world where Shopify, this was like 3 years ago, at least I think 4 years ago, maybe now. And so Shopify's the hosted platform's fantastic. Like there's not a lot of uses. I think a lot of the big reason people reach for headless is speed, but that's, I don't think an issue anymore. And it's not even that big of an issue in general. Like it's sort of a people look to that as like site speed is like the end all be all, but it's not really that important when it comes to a website. There's more important fish to fry in terms of the grand equation for conversion. So I would say like for the vast majority of merchants, it's definitely not worth it unless you want lots of pain.
I'd agree with that. I mean, we haven't, and you said like, hey, Shopify's, you know, the Shopify core, those tools have gotten better. In Headless's defense, the tools that one would use to build a headless Shopify site have gotten better as well. But it is a series of trade-offs where like you're giving up convenience to get just more significant control. We still have yet to build a headless site, but I have moved people from headless back to Shopify. And often they're like, just, hey, the trade-off there wasn't worth it. But, you know, I know there are people who defend it and enjoy it.
There's always people.
Yeah.
For anything, there's always people.
Ever wake up to customers canceling orders? Maybe they said, I shouldn't shop when I'm high. This was a gift. We broke up. Those are all real customer quotes. And they're all a real hassle for your customer and you. Why should the customer have to ask you to edit their order for them? What if they could do it themselves? Enter Cleverific. With Cleverific, you can empower your customers to make their own changes through a self-service portal. Cleverific is designed to reduce customer support tickets, ship orders faster, and even reduce returns and lost packages. Don't just take our word for it. Menswear retailer Peter Manning New York cut their order support queries by 99% with Cleverific. And they're not alone. Exclusively, for listeners of the Unofficial Shopify podcast, get 50% off Cleverific's Pro plan, now just $49 a month, giving you full access to everything Cleverific has to offer. Just go to cleverific.com/unofficial and use the promo code KURT50, that's K-R-U-T 50, at checkout to claim your discount. Take control with Cleverific and watch your customer support tickets plummet, shipping speeds increase, and package returns decrease. And all of that means happier customers. Back to your brand, back to Rainier Watch. It's very local, right? Do you have to be familiar with this, with the local landscape to appreciate this? You know, is that pro or con? Like, you've got this regional identity that is core to the marketing. Is there challenges to that? Give me your thoughts.
Yeah, being super niche is, there's trade-offs, but like it's really nice because people love the mountain and people are obsessed with it, and that's where the brand draws its identity, obviously, and the origin story and everything like that. So there's people that will be like super fans because of that and get behind it, and that's been really, really awesome to talk to people. Obviously, some limitations are smaller TAM and not having like as accessible target market.
TAM, what's total really addressable market.
Yeah, sorry. Throw out our acronyms. What's really interesting with that though is like before I looked at the data, I was thinking like most of the orders would be in Washington. That makes sense. Like it's a Washington thing. Over half the orders come from out of state. So it's a lot of people that have visited Mount Rainier or been in the Seattle area and seen Tahoma or Mount Rainier out and thought it was really cool, or used to live here, grew up here. I get messages and people writing in reviews and all sorts of context around that where it's like, hey, my grandpa grew up on a farm and I visited him when I was 6 years old and we could see the mountain out from our cow pasture and it was the coolest thing ever. So it's a lot of like hearkening to that.
I'm thinking out loud here. If you visit a tourist town, right, you're going to find lots of gift shops that sell lots of very local stickers and apparel. Could that be a lucrative in-store expansion effort for you? Like, are those opportunities out there? Have you thought about it?
Yeah, I've tried a little bit. Wholesale's tricky, especially as a founder, because it kind of feels like 1,000 slaps in the face until you get one yes. Small store owners like that are so crazy busy. Like they get 20 emails a day from people that are like, hey, put my stuff in your store, it'd be perfect. And so they're just inundated. And so a couple of years ago, I tried to put more of an effort into that where I'd be sourcing and searching and emailing and calling and all this and visiting all these local shops. And I just kind of got discouraged by it all because there was such a high rejection rate of like 90%+. And so I think there is some potential there. And I've gotten into the national park like last year, which was really cool. And so I'm definitely focused on a lot of the high traffic areas. But there are dozens of little boutiques and that sort of thing that have the more touristy kind of things that there could be some ROI there probably that's untapped.
Yeah. And at the same time, it may not be worth the effort. It's hard to know. You know, it's easy for me to suggest it and spend your time for you.
Yeah.
But I don't. You have done pop-up markets, in-person events. In other interviews, the businesses that have done those have been very successful because they're able to connect with people face-to-face. Tell me about your experience.
Yeah, I definitely recommend doing pop-ups and in-person events with people because I think that that close feedback loop is so key. Like being able to see what people are touching and gravitating towards and feeling and answering those questions and connecting with people in person, especially when it's around a shared love for the mountain. Like I've shared so many stories with people in person about talking about their experiences and their stories behind talking about Mount Rainier and also the interactions with the brand. A lot of the brand was built up about sharing on Instagram and Twitter when the mountain was out. And so people will come and be like, oh, hey, like you reshared my Twitter post or my Instagram story that one time. I'm like, oh, no way. That's really cool. I don't remember that, but it is awesome. Sometimes I do remember it though, but that personal connection, the brand is very, very community driven. And so having kind of boots on the ground and talking to people in person has been super important. And I did a, I don't know, 30 plus pop-ups over the last couple of years. I've taken the last year or so off because I have two small kids at home and weekends are for chasing them around and not chasing around customers in a marketplace. I would definitely recommend it to any founders out there because you can have that like really close personal connection with people and see exactly what they're looking at and touching. And that's not something you can really tell on a website as much.
And so that leads me to community. It seems you've managed to build a community around this, and that's been, part of the journey, but also, a part of the success. Tell me about what's worked for you for fostering that engagement or, helping keep that community engaged.
Yeah, community has been huge. And that's been one of the better parts over the years, especially on Instagram before they changed their algo. But like the Instagram community was massive and people were really involved with the brand. And now Instagram's sort of a struggle because they don't like to show posts to followers anymore. It's not about that.
I know. It's just like reels keep you swiping. And even if you do get a successful reel, it's so fleeting. Like, what's really the value there? I don't know anymore. Instagram's still fun, but...
Yeah, I could rant a lot about that. Because that built a lot of the brand. Like, Instagram, the Twitter or the Instagram account has like 60,000 followers or whatever. And a lot of that was built around a community of people who wanted to see more about the mountain and just like share that love for Mount Rainier. And none of, now the algorithm and all the likes and follows and like that sort of thing is so low compared to what those numbers are. And so that's been sort of a challenge. Like I have a private Facebook group and that's been somewhat successful, not as high as I'd like in terms of success. I'm a perfectionist. And so I judge everything by a very high standard and that hasn't been up to the standard that I want. And that's one of my focuses going forward. And that's why I built the Facebook group was like, hey, let's get back to the core concept of this and kind of just build a community around Mount Rainier. And how do we do that? Facebook group was one of the best options I thought. And so it's a focus. It's a challenge.
So that is one of the problems. You build an audience and build a community on a social media platform, but then years from now, you're always at their mercy. And so if you have a situation like Instagram where one day they just up and decide, guess what? We want to just rip off TikTok's formula and suddenly your posts don't show to people anymore. Or, Facebook, which essentially, like remember Facebook pages? We all had to have them. We all had to post them. And now it's not even a discussion anymore. Like, okay, Facebook groups are still a thing. For how long? It is, sometimes it feels like, you're building a house on quicksand with these social media platforms. Maybe that's just what we're supposed to expect, is these things are fleeting.
It's definitely hard. I don't know if there's really like a really good answer to where to build a community going forward, but it does feel like things are more splintered than usual nowadays. And that's where obviously with TikTok going bye-bye. Yeah, email's great and TikTok's going bye-bye. So it's like, who knows?
Yeah. Product development. I want to talk about that because you start with stickers, t-shirts. That's fairly easy. It's print on demand. But since then, you have expanded this product line. You've got a broader range of items. You're wearing a fleece jacket, which looks nice. What's your criteria? How do you decide what's getting added?
That's tough. I thought about hiring sort of a merchandising expert because I think I'm at the point where that will be a useful sort of consultant to come in and take a look at things. But it's because I don't know what I'm doing there. But basically, I do try and look at like what works and it's a lot of testing. I feel like that's what's tricky with an apparel brand because you're not sure exactly what's going to stick. And so it's a lot of me testing out different types of designs, different products, But essentially, it's like, it's pretty, you know, they're all kind of apparel. It's like t-shirts, hats, beanies. This jacket was my best-selling product ever. So I'm going to be leaning into that a little bit more, maybe a lot more into the future. And going back to like the TAM, like this is something that people that don't know about Mount Rainier aren't, you know, they're more apt to buy something like this rather than a hat that says Mount Rainier on it. And so it is kind of the brand expansion in my mind. So product developments, it's sometimes it's just kind of what I like in some ways. And it's a lot of trying to figure out what people want. And that is hard. It definitely, at the beginning, I was doing more print-on-demand t-shirts, print-on-demand sweatshirts, and trying to figure out like what was sticking and did it have viability there. That was sort of the MVP model at the time that I was building. And things were doing well. So I moved on from there. And that's kind of what you have to do is like take these baby steps to figure out like, hey, what's working? Look at what's working, double down on that and keep going and push that pedal and try and find those gas pedals, which are often very elusive.
And so you know, that approach where it's iterative, you're working through revisions of products or product lines. I was curious if you have an example of how customer feedback has changed a product over time.
Oh, the t-shirts. So the t-shirts are interesting. I basically made these, I guess this is more of an example of how marketing's changed based on customer feedback, but it's very interesting because the t-shirts that I started with a couple of years ago, I call them the eco tees, and I landed on using them because they're the most eco-friendly t-shirts out there. There's like five different hugely cool things about them from an eco-friendly standpoint. It's like 100 gallons of water saved by each t-shirt, 6 recycled water bottles saved from the ocean, carbon neutral, sustainable trees, like all these ingredients that go into it that are really like sustainable or ethical manufacturing, all these things. And I've evolved the story around them a little bit because when I look at a lot of the customer feedback and the reviews and talk to customers, the number one reason that people buy them is that they're butter smooth. They're super, super soft. And they're comfortable. And like, that's been really interesting because it's sort of a evolution in how I do marketing and how I'm thinking about products is, hey, listen to your customer a little bit more, David. you know, the people say that, but it's true. And so that narrative around this product line has shifted a little bit more into the comfort arena. And like, this is going to be the top t-shirt that you grab in your drawer because it's the most comfortable. And that's what people are saying and leaning into those reviews. And that's evolved a lot of the storytelling around those products. And it's kind of also shifted my grand thinking process when it comes to products. Like, I want to focus a lot more on perhaps comfort. Eco-friendly is still going to be important to me because that's like one of my values and it's what I want the brand to be. And it also makes sense as sort of a mission-driven company to have a focus on sustainability and making sure that the earth is around in its current state for my daughter and my son. Like, those are important elements of the brand that I want to involve, but like, that might not be important to anyone else, or it might just be the underlying that makes them feel good after the purchase. And so
I would suspect, though, for an outdoor-focused brand, that sustainability becomes more important more often for your customers. Are you familiar with Shopify Planet?
Yeah, is that the carbon offset program?
Yes.
Yeah, I use that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah,
we did an episode about Shopify Planet, and that's cool. Why I asked. Yeah, they have that cool badge that tells you like this is how much it's offset. I like Planet, but there is some cause marketing here. Like, you donate a portion of your sales to national parks or wildfire relief.
Yep.
How has that social impact influenced, you know, the brand, your marketing, or benefited you?
Going back to like what I was saying, it's a lot of, I haven't really tested conversion rates, but from what I read and a lot of what I hear from people that are smarter than me, like it is kind of that underline that makes the customer feel good about the purchase. And that makes a lot of sense to me. And it's kind of more of like, these are things that tie directly, like you're saying, it's an outdoor brand that's focused on sort of this shared love for Mount Rainier. And so donating back to the mountain just makes sense. Like, it's kind of supporting the parks, giving back. I think that there are people that definitely care about that. And there are customers that definitely care about that. And that's been part of the brand for many, many years, and being a member of 1% for the planet. And so using those USPs as sort of the underlying after the purchase or during the purchase, I think helps. But I think in the past, I've fallen into the trap of thinking that it's like the number one reason why people buy. And I'm not sure that's entirely true. I think it's more of like a secondary supplemental sort of like, this is good. So I'm going to purchase it, or I'm going to purchase it, but oh, I'm really going to purchase it now kind of thing.
Hey, aren't you forgetting something? If you're not using one-click upsell, you're leaving 10 to 15% of your total Shopify revenue on the table. One-click upsell is the number one upsell app for over 15,000 Shopify stores. Listen to these brands: Tushy, Dr. Squatch, Buffy and Victoria Beckham, and guess what? It's already made sellers just like you an extra $750 million in upsell revenue. With one-click upsell, you can add AI-powered upsell funnels to every product on your store, including upsells on your product pages, shopping cart, checkout, and thank you page, even on the shop app. So you increase your average order value automatically, and getting started is a breeze. You can install the app, launch your first upsell, and start making 10 to 15% more cash from every customer beginning on day one, as in today. Don't leave behind another dollar in free upsell revenue. Go to zipify.com/Kurt and try one click upsell free for 30 days. That's zipify.com/KURT. It sounds like customers are more likely to buy because of these social impact initiatives, but also it reinforces the brand's values and adds all important authenticity. Do you ever get challenged on transparency or authenticity because you have these, you know, social values as part of the brand?
Not that often. There are people that challenge some of the different initiatives that I've done. I've done initiatives to help support diversity and inclusion in the outdoors and giving back to nonprofits and organizations that support LGBTQ and BIPOC initiatives in the outdoors, because those are folks that don't feel safe. And a lot of people struggle to understand that who aren't part of those communities. And so there's been a lot of pushback, especially in Facebook ads. Facebook ads are where
The Facebook comments, though. What do you?
Yeah.
So when you get a crappy Facebook comment on an ad, because that, for a lot of people, they seem to get some joy out of leaving crappy comments on ads, right? They're like, "Ha, you tried to make me buy, but I outsmarted you. You know, good job, buddy." How do you handle those? What do you do with them?
I feel like there's 1% of humanity that's just sitting there on Facebook ads, like, "I'm gonna get them. I'm gonna get them. This is gonna drive them crazy." Yeah,
got him.
For a little while, like, it kind of needled me, because I was responding to all those myself, and it felt like little kind of jabs, because this is my brand, this is my passion project, like, I care a lot and deeply about this, and it's like all these little things where it's like, blah, 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 I'm like, oh, ouch, ouch. But I've gotten a thicker skin, and one thing I've done over the last couple months is I've started to use AI. here's the big buzzword that everyone's talking about over the last couple of years, but I've used ChatGPT to answer a lot of these Facebook comments, and I feel like it sort of has added a protective layer to my ego, I guess, because it's not me answering it. I'm like, you go right on response, because it took a little bit. It took like more effort to answer the ad comment when it was negative and felt like it was hurting me or hurting the brand when it was myself responding. But when it's someone else writing it and it's like, oh yeah, that looks good, here we go, boom, boom, that addresses all their concerns and was very nice and not as snarky as I would be. So we're cool. But there's been countless times where I have hide, delete, block, I think that's the order, to people that leave silly, like, obviously not going to be a customer, goodbye kind of comments.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff that, like, you look at it and you know immediately it is not worth engaging with. This person is not here
for troll.
They're just a troll. They don't want you to convince them. But they certainly want the engagement. And so, yeah, those you just dump. And then some, you know, you could kind of tell, like, oh, they're pushing back, but not necessarily in a mean-spirited way, or maybe like a place of genuine curiosity. And those are worthwhile to respond to. But ChatGPT as a writing partner can be, garbage in, garbage out. If you tell it, like, look, this is the situation, this is the context, this is what I'm trying to say, be my editor, be my writing partner, help me do this without being emotionally involved, invested. That's where it really can shine in situations like that, because you are, it is not emotional, right? In the same way that you are, it could kind of empathize a little bit, but Yeah, no, it takes the sting out of it. And it honestly, it'll keep you from saying something stupid.
Yeah. What I want to say versus what ChatGPT said.
Yeah. And yeah, when it has the context, it's funny. Like I've given it situations like that and it'll be like, oh boy, tensions are really hot here. We gotta cool things off. It's kind of funny. For a lot of Shopify brands that are starting out, you know, they'll get everything right. The look, the brand, the product, you know, they'll start to reach an audience. But then the thing that's always missing, that's hard, that because it's such a soft skill, is brand storytelling. And that's a thing that you have mastered. You're able to communicate because this came out of a genuine love and hobby over a decade. And so tell me about that storytelling aspect of this brand.
I'd say mastered used lightly in that context, but I'm still learning. I'm still learning a lot about storytelling. I think that it is, especially these days with running a brand, like I feel like there's so many brands out there. It's so easy to throw like a website up and a cool template and that sort of thing and make some sweet products or whatever. And sometimes the brand is just kind of empty or void when you peek behind the curtain. And that's the storytelling brings the humanity to it. And it kind of is able to make it more of a real thing rather than just kind of a website or a cool veneer kind of thing. I wouldn't say I'm great at it. I'm definitely learning a lot better by watching other brands that are doing more storytelling. I short form video obviously is super hot these days, and I'm trying to lean into that a little bit more, even over the last couple of weeks, where it's me making a video about going to REI to do a restock, for example. Like that did pretty well the other day. I want to lean into more of my own sort of founder-led company persona for marketing reasons, because people buy from people these days. That's why influencers have been so huge over the last few years, is, you know, people will still buy from brands, but I think we're seeing a decline of that, where it's like people buy from people, and that's kind of putting that humanity behind the brand and telling the story of, hey, this is the brand. This, like, I started tweeting, I started with $200-$300 and built this brand into something that's like hopefully gonna hit seven figures in the next year or two. We'll see. But
yeah, I think kiss of death is when the customer goes to an about page, because like they're interested in the product, but they don't know the brand. They're not familiar. And they'll go to the about page to get a sense of it. And there'll be an about page, but it will be in a generic story that starts with, here at Acme Corp, and then there are no photos, there's no names. And immediately that reads to me as suspicious, right? And I don't buy.
People don't like dropshippers, and that's kind of what some of those could be possibly. And there was a brand the other, like literally in the last week or two, I bounced from a website because I did that same thing, went to the about page. There's a couple sentences, no pictures, like, okay, so see you later. I'm going to go check out someone else.
You know, the photos, the person behind it, like that's the thing that's harder to fake. An about page, I can rip that off from anywhere and then have ChatGPT rewrite it. It's not okay, you did the easy part. So with your experience in this journey has been really entirely self-taught. What do you wish you knew when you started?
So many things. How much time do you have? I think that it's really hard. So I've been, for those that don't know me, like there's a space of Twitter where it's called DTC Twitter, where it's like a very niche part of the internet where there's a bunch of people in the e-com DTC space that share tips and help each other out and all sorts of stuff, for better or worse, and fight about cost caps and bid caps and no caps and all the things. But I've been in that space. Like I check Twitter daily almost during times when I shouldn't probably. And I'm trying to lay off it more. But it's been really fun. And that's taught me so much. But also, I think that if I could go back, I would tell myself like, hey, don't pay attention. Don't look at the shiny objects. Like there's a lot of advice out there that gets shilled that doesn't make sense for your brand or your context or the life cycle of where you're at in your brand. Like you don't need this. I've fallen prey to this so many times. Like I've had way too many apps installed in my Shopify store. You don't need all the apps. You don't need to focus on like your post purchase after sell conversion rate and like optimizing that, because that's not the biggest gas pedal to push. You need to focus on margins, profitability, and what's going to push the brand forward the most. And I think that's something I've tried to incorporate a lot more over the last 2 years, is not focus on the little tiny shiny object things, the fun, sexy things, but focus on a lot of the core fundamentals that will build a foundation of being able to push the brand forward into the next level, which for this brand is like the seven figure range. And that is going to be Facebook ads or whatever. Like for this brand, it's probably Facebook ads, but for a lot of other brands, it's probably something else. Could be something else. A lot of brands, I do think Facebook ads are the bread and butter, but it's focusing on a lot of those fundamentals that are like, don't build a hell of a site. Just go to Shopify, build a Shopify site. It doesn't have to be pretty. Like you look at brands that don't have pretty websites that are doing way more in terms of revenue. And that's not really the most important thing. Product market fit is super, super key. Margins are super key. That storytelling aspect comes like is woven into all of this in the context of the brand. Like building the brand is way more than installing a couple new Shopify apps. It's about getting out there and figuring out what people want and finding those people and figuring out how to acquire those customers and how to get them back in the door.
It is excellent advice. It is not obvious to people who are new, right? You know, it could be counterintuitive. But I think it's important. You got to avoid the stuff that is the distractions. There's a lot of things that feel like work and positive reinforcement, like especially social media and organic social and that stuff, that, you know, absolutely is not necessarily going to get you far. And you're right. Thinking about contribution margin is hugely important. Especially for apparel brands, it's entirely possible to discount yourself into a death spiral of like high revenue, no profit.
It's
early in the year. You got big plans. Looking forward, what are some of the future projects or goals for Rainier Watch?
I'm most excited for jackets. This is something I'm going to be leaning into, like I hinted at earlier. This thing was amazing. It was my fastest selling product, like including the pre-sale. It sold out in less than a week. And I'm going to be making a lot more jackets in the future. It's interesting because it's taken me so long to realize this, but like I love jackets and my friends in college would call me the jacket master, which was a little silly, and I have way too many in our closet kind of thing. Like my wife has told me many times, you have too many jackets, but it's interesting because you want to lean in. I feel like as a brand owner, like it's important to lean into what you're good at and like what you know. And I know jackets really, really well. And like, I know a lot of the details and to build this thing, I tested and looked at like half a dozen other jackets and tested it over 6+ months and got to a final state where it was pretty awesome. And so that's something where I'm really excited. Like I want to spend all my time just designing new jackets and I'm already laying out all these different ideas for different seasonal drops and that sort of thing. And there's a lot of different criteria underneath the hood that why it makes sense in terms of like margins are good and all these other things that where it does seem like a really good product and a possible, like I'm excited because I feel like I finally found maybe a hero product that does pretty well. My ads were doing super, super well for it. Like best ads I've ever had, consistently performing like really good ROAS and everything. So that's probably like the biggest thing I'm looking forward to over the next year. I think I'm also been focusing a lot of core concepts underneath the hood, foundational stuff that's like margins and sort of trimming out fat and operational things that are not sexy and not fun, but I need to get better at. And I've also been using a VA a lot more over the last couple months, as well as ChatGPT, as sort of force multipliers to make me and my tasks faster and speed up things. And I think that will help lean itself to be a better operation over the next year. I think because it's been a really cool journey over the last couple of years for the brand and it's been awesome, but there's been very low lights and there's been like near death sort of situations where I overbought on certain things and had maxed out Amex, like my business Amex got frozen a couple times over this last year. There's a lot of times that I think social media is a highlight reel and it's too often easy to compare yourself to the highlight reel and fall into that trap of like, oh, this other brand's doing amazing, blah, blah, blah. They're doing super cool. But there's could be a lot of things that are broken underneath the surface. And trying to keep it real and just trying to like focus on fixing a lot of those things is definitely something that won't be as fun. But I'm hoping that once I start to get a lot of that figured out going forward, like it'll help to build the brand better.
I agree with you. It's a breath of fresh air to hear someone be honest and admit like, hey, it's not perfect and social media is not real. I think we all need that reminder. And it's like when you see people post about their personal lives, I think we all know like, oh yeah, that's the highlight reel. You know, they're not telling you about the time like they got in a fight with their spouse. They got a speeding ticket. Like that super stuff doesn't make it to social media. Mm-hmm. But in business, I think it's especially true because there it's like, well, I have to show how successful I am to create more opportunity. Sometimes being vulnerable is the thing you need to do. We're starting to figure that out in personal branding. I wish business branding, we could figure that out as well. My Final question for you, other than where can I get one of those fabulous coats, is what advice do you have that you want to impart to other Shopify entrepreneurs?
Just go out there. I don't know. There's so many things that you don't know until you try it. And I think doing it and having that, you know, you'll fail a lot. There's a lot of things that I've failed at and a lot of low lights and highlights in the roller coaster of running a brand of the last couple of years. And I'm better for it. Like having had those experiences and it's been super stressful and I've had crazy hard moments in running the brand, but you don't know until you do it. And it can be really fun, but it's also can be really, really hard.
For sure. It's never going to be easy, but you live for, you know, when it works and when it's fun and solving the challenges. Also, you know, when you break through, feels great. It's that success can be addictive, and that's what we live for with entrepreneurship, man. All right, David Lindahl, Rain Your Watch. Where do I go? How do I get one of these fabulous coats?
Well, they're basically sold out. So
I need to get on the list then.
Yeah, you do. You do. You definitely do. Shop.rainyourwatch.com is the website. The fleece jackets will be on there. There's a sign up notification you can get in case one happens to bubble up from the internet or return or that sort of thing. But there will be lots of epic more things coming very, very soon. So stay tuned on that.
And you do have like a ton of great hats and stuff. I got to go do some shopping. David Lindahl, Rain Your Watch, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kurt. Appreciate it.
Crowdfunding campaigns are great. You can add social proof and urgency to your product pre-orders while reducing risk of failure. But with traditional crowdfunding platforms, you're paying high fees and giving away control, all while your campaign is lost in a sea of similar offers. It can be frustrating. That's why we built Crowdfunder, the Shopify app that turns your Shopify product pages into your own independent crowdfunding campaigns. We originally created Crowdfunder for our private clients, and it was so successful, we turned it into an app that anyone can use. Today, merchants using Crowdfunder have raised millions collectively. With Crowdfunder, you'll enjoy real-time tracking, full campaign control, and direct customer engagement. And it's part of the Built for Shopify program, so you know it's easy to use. So say goodbye to high fees and hello to successful store-based crowdfunding. Start your free trial and transform your Shopify store into a pre-order powerhouse today. Search Crowdfunder in the Shopify App Store to get started.